Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Hello, listeners. In tonight's episode, we're going to be focusing on a tragic event that played out in Winnipeg, Manitoba on January 1st of 1970. Although over 50 years have come and gone since the events of that night, the ripple effects are still echoing throughout multiple generations of the family affected. The story centers around Geraldine Sittie, an 11-year-old girl who left home with some change in her pocket and a craving for a snack from a neighborhood drugstore, a short, safe walk away. When Geraldine didn't return within the expected time, her father Leonard grew worried. And that worry turned to panic when he learned the drugstore wasn't even open that evening. Where is Geraldine? A gruesome discovery the next morning would answer that question, but create many more, and of course, forever change the Sittie family. As the official investigation failed to identify the person or persons responsible for the young girl's death, the task seemed to have found a champion in another Sittie family member. Although he never met his Aunt Geraldine, our guest has made it his mission to bring awareness to her case and hopefully answer the questions that have been haunting his family for the last 50 years. So let's get to it. Tonight, in this episode of Nighttime, our topic is the unsolved murder of 11-year-old Geraldine Sittie. So just to start, why don't you tell me a little bit about you. Who are you? Where are you?
I'm in located in Winnipeg, and I'm 43 years old. I've lived here all my life. I like to play guitar. You know, I like to collect vintage equipment, pedals, guitars, amps, and stuff like that. And yeah, a bit of a car guy as well. I have a couple of Mustangs.
Oh man.
2005 Mustang GT, and in 1999. Yeah, nice. Helps keep me young.
You're 43, you're into sports cars and guitars. So yeah, I guess it's working.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about Geraldine Sittie. Am I pronouncing her last name right? Sittie?
You can go either Sittie or Sittie. There's pronunciations. I appreciate you asking that. Some people think it's actually Sittie. They think it's French, right? There's been that, but yeah, whatever you prefer.
How do you say it?
I say it Sittie. I used to say it Sittie, but I think it sounds maybe a little bit more distinguished than saying Sittie. So we'll go with that.
Okay. Now with Geraldine's story, I have to ask, first of all, what connects you or how are you connected to Geraldine and her story? Because I know this is something really important to you. What is your connection to Geraldine?
Well, I mean, the connection is that, I mean, I was born in 1978, right? So she was killed in 1970. So I was too young to have ever met her. And I think I was about 8 or 9 years old or something like that when my dad told me that I had an Aunt Geraldine that was murdered where Junior's is on St. Mary's Road.
Wow. So Geraldine was your father's sister?
Yes. And she was mm-hmm. the youngest in the family. She was a baby. And she was about 7 years younger than my dad. And he was one of the youngest as it was. Like, it was Geraldine, then my dad. And then so hit my dad hard.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Now, this happened in 51 years ago. I believe it was January 1st of 70. What now, 51 years later, like, what do you think it is that has got you so motivated to find out what happened to her and to get the story out there? Like, is there anything that really set this off where you're like, you know, I need to figure this out and work for Geraldine?
Yeah, you know, it's about 3.5 months ago that I thought, I just want to go into it trying to find out information and help if I could in any way. I didn't know what I could actually do. And I just thought, well, you know, I mean, there's so much time has passed that, I mean, the people that might know information here, getting pretty old now. And people are, you know, memories are fading and they're getting Alzheimer's and dementia and stuff like that. And I thought, well, you know, if we don't do it soon, she'll be permanently in the cold case file. And that's just not okay.
And so I know, like, just as you mentioned, the last several months, you've really been, you know, digging and connecting dots in Geraldine's story and digging up a lot of old articles, which have been invaluable in learning her story. Prior to this, did you know the details of what happened to her? And if so, like, what to what extent did you know the story versus what you know now? Like, growing up, as you, like, I'm sure you heard the basics, but how much of it did you learn since you got a new stimulated interest, I guess, over the last several months?
That's a great question. My dad just told me, and the family just kind of told me some rudimentary facts that there was a main suspect that was, and that he was released. And we didn't know the extent of that. And I thought that suspect was innocent. I'm like, hey, none of us wants to see anybody innocent going to jail. And that's happened many times in the course of police history anywhere, is that they have the wrong people, and then it's kind of twofold. It's the wrong person went to jail, and the killer is still out there. So, but in talking to my dad about 3.5 months ago, I asked him to really open up about it, and I was amazed what he told me.
And you as well, like I mentioned there in my question, is that you've also gone through, like, the, I guess, probably the Manitoba equivalent of, like, public archives, because you've been sharing a lot of the original news articles, which have the story in so much more detail than the modern contemporary versions that have been shared. Like, there was a piece CBC did that was kind of like a recap of Geraldine's story, but it was just a couple paragraphs long. And it didn't include a lot of the details in the original articles that you shared. Like, that must have been eye-opening going through the old papers.
Oh, for sure. I should say, yeah, really, that was the eye-opener. It's like, I mean, that was back in a time where, I mean, the news was relied on to get it right. They didn't always get it right, of course. But, I mean, it was, when you see it in big, bold font back then, it really hit me. I think it really has that impact this much later to just, like, wow. You start to really fill in the blanks and go, something more here.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, before we get into Geraldine's life and the actual timeline of the events that led to her death, what I'd be curious to hear is, like, at present day, how is this story discussed in your family? Like, as you mentioned, your dad's still here and talking about it. What about his siblings and, you know, other members of your family? How do they look at Geraldine's story? Does she come up often?
I don't think she comes up that often, because it's a painful topic, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously I can't imagine what it would be like, right? I have my own version of anger and frustration and concern, but I mean, I just cannot imagine what it would be like, because my aunt actually found her the next day frozen in the snow. That's tough, man. That's tough.
You had mentioned, like, when you talked to your dad just a few months ago, and you're like, you know, open up to me, Dad. Like, is it something where you really kind of, like, had to, like, hold his hand and, like, force him into discussing it, or did he seem pretty open to talking to you about this?
He was really open to it, because he's 69 now. And that was his little sister, and, you know, I didn't know how passionate he still was until I talked about it.
Let's talk a bit about Geraldine's life. So at the time she was killed, she was 11 years old.
Correct.
What do you know about her life at that point? The only thing really I could put together from the various articles is that they have a very big family. She was one of 10. So your dad and her and a whole bunch of others must have been a very big family.
Yeah, it was a really big family. And what I think is really neat and interesting is I asked my dad and some of my family members and aunts and uncles, like, what it was like moving from Matheson Island out in rural Manitoba. It's like northeast of Winnipeg, and it's right along Lake Winnipeg. And I asked him, like, what was it like moving to Winnipeg? And he said, well, you know, they had a 1953 Dodge, loaded up the family, and, I mean, took the risk to move to Winnipeg. And my granny and grandpa did it because they wanted a better future for their family. That's a big family, and, you know, Matheson Island, the only industry was really fishing and trapping and hunting. And they realized that in order to provide a better life for their family, that they need to do that. And I really respect my grandparents for that. Mm-hmm.
So you were born yourself in Winnipeg, though, but your dad would have been born in the small island you mentioned?
Yeah. Yeah, they were, even Geraldine was. So she was about four, I think, when they moved to Winnipeg. It was about 1960.
Okay. And what I put together from the articles as well is this, the section of Winnipeg that your family was living in, that Geraldine was living in, was seen as like a good neighborhood. And the reason I say that is because when we get into the story, the story involves Geraldine like going out to the store in the evening. But my understanding is it's not like they lived in like a rough part of town. I know things are probably different now, but in the 1970s, do you know much about the area that they were living in? Or at least how do you perceive kind of that community at that point?
Even back then, it was very affluent neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, just down the street was, I mean, a street that had a lot of judges and lawyers and people with wealth and influence and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, my grandparents really took a big swing there. They could have moved to the North End where it would have been rougher, but they said, no, we're going to move to the suburb of St. Paul. It's safe. Everybody knows everybody and stuff like that. And that's what really kind of blows my mind, is that it still is a very safe neighborhood. You can go there, I mean, you can raise a family, and there's no problems. I mean, I grew up there in the 80s. I could ride my bike. My parents just, they had no concern. You know, the only thing was a busy street, and you had to worry about that. But stay, go out and have fun.
Yeah. So the story mainly involves the evening of January 1st, 1970. Geraldine is at, my understanding is she's at home on a Thursday night and decides she wants to go to like a local kind of convenience store or drugstore, because I think she just wanted to get like a bag of chips, is my understanding, or like some kind of treat or something. And she asks who would be your grandfather for permission to make a quick run to the store. Am I getting that right?
Pretty much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was actually my grandfather that sent her out to the store on January 1st and to say, hey, go pick up some snacks and pop and chips and some matchsticks for me as well. And it was about 25 minutes later that it was like, well, she should be home by now. And okay. They started calling around to her friends and stuff like that. And I was like, no, she's not here. And that was, you know, as a parent, that's when you really start to worry.
Yeah, and I understand as well that the worry was even more justified when they realized that the store actually, like, I don't know if it had closed earlier, but for whatever reason, I believe your granddad determined that not only was she not home when he'd expect her to have been home, but he found out that the drugstore like wasn't even open at that point. So something obviously was happening.
Exactly. I believe with all the information and stuff like that, that the store closed at 6 p.m. that night and she went out at 8. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, that would make my grandfather feel even worse with that. I can't imagine how he would have felt.
They do an initial search of the area that night, that Thursday evening. But as far as I know, there's no sign or trace of her found. Like, do you know much about the initial search that evening? Like what would have happened, or where they looked, or what they did?
As far as I can tell, that wooded area, like they looked around the perimeter of it, but they didn't see anything in there. it wasn't until the next morning that my aunt actually, they went deeper into that wooded area and then found her there.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard to tell what facts are when you're looking at 50-year-old newspapers, but yeah. One of the articles that I read had indicated that somebody had called, well, what's now 911, but was then 999, that someone had phoned there Friday and said, like, she is wherever, and then hung up the call. Do you know if there's any truth to this, like, anonymous 999 caller giving the location? Do you know much about this?
Actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was told by one of my family members that it was another one of my family members that they were with that were in the search party, that once they found her body, that this other family member actually ran into an apartment block, which is where Junior's is, and just knocked on somebody's door. Hey, can I use your phone? Can I use your phone? And then they called from there. And then this family member ran back before they could say their name. So this helps clear up one of those kind of misconceptions, because I was thinking, oh, well, you know, the perpetrator wasn't the person calling, right? So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. When you read the article, it makes it seem like it was this anonymous person, but
exactly. But
that makes so much more sense. So the next morning, friends and family would have been out searching in more detail than they would have in the evening before, and would have had the benefit of the sun being up, and they found Geraldine.
Exactly. Yep.
And when they find her, it's I'm assuming, based on what I know about the story, it must have been pretty obvious that there was foul play, because she met a violent end. What the initial news reports outline is multiple stab wounds is what ended her life. I don't know if you've ever seen any medical documents on what the cause of death was, but I'm thinking with multiple stab wounds, it was likely blood loss.
Probably, yeah. They said any one of the six stab wounds could have been fatal. I think it was three in the front and three in the back or something like that.
And with I saw as well, it's a 7-inch blade on the knife. So this isn't a small little pocket knife or something. Like, she would have been seriously injured. And she was an 11-year-old girl. So that would be a very serious injuries for her.
Absolutely, yeah.
They did find the money, although, again, a small amount of money was still with her, which would lead you to think that robbery may not have been a motive. It's just when you hear a story of a young girl, something like this happens to you, suspect, could there have been like a sexual motive? But it seems that that wasn't the case either. Like, do you have any idea of what the motive was, or is there any information that could hint towards what someone's motive was to do this to an 11-year-old girl running to the store?
Well, yeah, you bring up some really good points there. When I started with this, that reopening it, I was kind of like, I mean, rereading those articles, it's kind of like, well, okay, I mean, robbery was the motive, and she wasn't sexually assaulted, and which is great. I mean, it's just kind of odd, living over four decades on this planet, you kind of go through the kind of profile types and stuff like that of who might do this sort of thing. And it seems to be a pure power, a pure just killing for the sake of it, right? Because if you don't need the money, if it's not sexually related, then you really are a truly warped mind.
Well, I think the police chief at the time, even in a press conference the next day or the couple days after, had said, like, I think their exact words was something like, we have a kook on the loose. So they made no secret of the fact that the suspicion,
or screwball, is on the loose.
Yeah, kook or screwball. So from the very beginning, that seemed to be their what they were going on, is that it was likely a random attack by a kook or a screwball. And I guess I can understand that, because it's not like an 11-year-old is going to, like, you know, owe money to the mob or have made any enemies. Like, there's nothing about it makes sense. Now, when I first started reading about Geraldine's story, it's the next piece that really it just blows my mind is when they were looking for a motive or trying to figure out who may have done this to Geraldine, your grandfather, her father, had recalled like disturbing phone calls that were made to the house about a month prior. What do you know about these calls? Like, what was the story you got about these calls that were made? I believe December 5th is the date I saw.
Yeah, it was December 5th and 6th that it was on, yeah, December 5th, 1969, that she got that disturbing, dirty, and vulgar phone call. And that, I mean, basically on there, it was that he'd be watching her all the time. And it was an adolescent. So, I mean, I'm assuming there's probably some suggestive things that he said in there and things like that. And there was a call on the 6th, but that wasn't actually from anybody that was threatening her. Just she fainted because she was worried that there was going to be another harassing phone call.
This harassing phone call, do you know if like, I don't know how much detail you know about it, but was it, did she just happen to answer the phone and hear something awful? Or was it someone possibly targeting her, like, you know, looking for her? Do you know much about how it came to be her on the phone with this person?
That's a good question, because I've asked my family if they know exactly what might have happened. I mean, my grandparents would probably know the best on that, but they're both unfortunately deceased now. And so, yeah, I don't know if the caller asked for her or whether she picked up the phone or whatever like that. But I do know that she had talked directly to her.
And was so disturbed by it that, as you had already said, shortly after when the phone rang again, she got so like riddled with anxiety, I guess, that she actually passed out at the thought of another call.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. One can totally understand that, right?
An 11-year-old, yeah.
Especially back then, there was no call display or any way to trace that type of thing. It's, you pick up the phone, it's crapshoot, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And now, so that's one kind of avenue as to who this call is. If it's just a random, lewd call, it's a pretty big coincidence that happens a month prior to a random murder. But also, there were two other cases of young women in that area that seemed to be attacked or threatened right around the same time as Geraldine. That, at least in my mind, I can't imagine that they're not connected in some way. I'm assuming you read up a bit about these two women that I believe are threatened with a knife.
Yeah. Yeah, there was, it was printed in the paper on December 14th, 1969. And then December
24th. So weeks before Geraldine was killed.
Yeah. And also the attacks on the 24th and the 26th. I mean, it's like holiday. You have to be truly warped mind to, be doing this stuff on the holiday, because, I mean, you should be out with friends or family or having fun. That makes it especially warped, because I just can't imagine.
Yeah. And these other attacks, like, what would lead someone to think that they're connected to Geraldine, or what similarities do they have with what happened to Geraldine?
Well, one that we know for sure is that there was a girl that was attacked in a back lane on Hull Avenue. And clearly there was somebody in the neighborhood targeting people in back lanes and stuff like that. Because can you imagine being a parent back then? I mean, especially it was targeting girls, and just in this like 2 or 3 block radius. It's like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. What's happening?
And I read that same article, and I believe the attacker pulled a knife and kind of ordered the young woman into the alley. And the article didn't give much detail other than to say they didn't hurt her specifically, but they at knife point forced her to watch the person with the knife commit a lewd act on himself. So I'm thinking it kind of sounds sexual. I'm not sure what that lewd act is, but I can use my imagination. But the fact that a knife was involved. They described this young woman who went through that experience in the alleyway. She described the attacker as being somewhere between like 15 and 17 years old. So another young man.
Yeah, that was what was reported in the paper at that time. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's where it gets even more complicated. So we have lewd calls, these other attacks, which I think are likely related. What happens to Geraldine? But it doesn't stop there, because there actually was an arrest made. And it seems like, you know, in a small town like that, not a small town, but in a small neighborhood like that, it seems like these crimes appear to be isolated to this one area. Like, I'm not surprised that they were able to pick someone up pretty quick, but they went as far as to like do a full investigation, make an arrest, lay charges, I believe. Maybe they did lay charges, but then it didn't go to trial or anything. I guess the charges were just dropped.
It went to trial, but the trial was stayed. And I found it was the stayed for an apparent lack of evidence on it. Oh. And this boy that was 14 at the time that Geraldine was murdered, but 16 at the time of when he was charged for going to trial. He was released on $10,000 bail the next day, reported in the paper after that. I mean, $10,000 at that time in St. Patel would have bought you a pretty nice house.
It's a significant amount. Oh, well, she went to the store with $1.30.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So 10 grand is a sizable amount of money. And just, you mentioned the age there, 14 at the time of her murder, 16 at the time of his arrest. There's kind of two important things there. For one is the age, 14, would put this suspect in the right age to be connected to those other cases as well. You know, if they're looking for a 14 to 17-ish year old. So there's that. But also, if they didn't make the arrest until 2 years later, that would tell me that the investigation, I don't want to give them too much credit, but they didn't jump to conclusions and arrest someone. There must have been some investigation happening that would take that amount of time. They would have had enough evidence to justify the laying of charges, but not enough to actually bring it to trial. So I would love to know what they evidence they had and what evidence they lacked that led to the charges being stayed.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of those things where, I mean, we're getting into like a half a century's worth of urban legends and myths being passed down and going around the neighborhood, and, you know, people whispering and, hey, did you know this, and everything like that. That, I mean, we're not sure exactly what is what's fact and what's fiction.
It's not going to be unique to Geraldine's story, but whenever like a crime like this happens, especially to a child, it just, like, people talk, rumor mills start. What, like, growing up around this story and still being in that area, like, what are the rumors or the speculation that's out there as to what may have happened? Have you heard a lot?
Yeah, you know, in gathering a lot of facts and stuff like that, and just talking to people and what they heard or what they know and stuff like that, what happened back then is, I think it might have been not properly handled, right? The police did the best they could. I spoke with the police about 3 months ago, 3.5 months ago when I started this, and the file is massive. I mean, he put a condensed file in front of me, and it was about like that. And so they did a lot of homework. They did a lot of work. And I don't know if there was something that may have compromised it. Maybe the suspect was questioned without a parent or lawyer present. I'm not sure. You know, some people think that. Some people think maybe there was evidence obtained without a warrant, stuff like that.
But I guess a lot of it at this point is hearsay. And it's still an...
Yeah.
Like, as far as the activeness of the file? Like when you met with an investigator, how did they describe the current situation? Like, are they still doing any investigation or involved? Because if this was a 14-year-old or that did it, possibly, and a 16-year-old that had charge of state, this person is likely still on the planet. Like, are they still looking into this at all?
The main suspect indeed is alive and turned 66 in August of this year. So
okay.
In meeting with the police, one of the things that they did say is that in 2008, there was somebody that was going to testify and that they had an overdose and then got amnesia.
Oh, that was going to testify against the original suspect?
That was going to testify, yes, against the original suspect.
Were the police and I understand there would have been rules at the time about what information could have been shared, because the original articles just refer to him as like a 16-year-old. Were the investigators that you met with open with who this person was? Like, did they give you any details?
They were very open, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had said turned 66. Like, maybe you can give me an idea of what information that they shared with you about this person.
Well, I mean, they had a big file and everything like that. And I mean, in their words, the main suspect is still the person that's mainly
The main and seemingly the only suspect, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Kind of seems like it's the only. I mean, they had other suspects. There was one, I think, a middle-aged man reading the articles back then. I think it was like in his 40s or something like that, that had a history of molestation and sexually abusing girls and stuff like that. But I don't think he was a serious suspect, but he was somebody of interest, right? But then, you know, you start to rule things out, and she wasn't sexually assaulted, so it just seems like something that wouldn't be in the MO for like a middle-aged pervert, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how many other suspects there were, but I mean, it's...
And I can't help but always, like, I think as I hear her story, and even if I read it with different suspects, I'm going to be thinking of Geraldine's case with the other cases we discussed. I see it all as one, because I can't imagine that in the same area within, you know, a 2-week span, the situation happened in the alleyway with the young man with the knife, and then Geraldine is murdered in another isolated area by knife. In that original, that other attack described it as a young, you know, 14 to 17-year-old man, I believe, what they said, which wouldn't fit the MO of, you know, if there's an older pervert and this young man with a knife within a 2-week period in this, you know, a well-to-do area, it just seems like that would be like an unusual frequency of kind of freak attacks to happen. Now, with this story still being out, or with you putting this story out and uncovering these details, what are you like hoping to get out of this? Is it, I can only imagine this, there, if there's this man is still on this planet, are you hoping that maybe new evidence will come forward, or what is your motivation in uncovering and sharing Geraldine's story?
Well, first of all, I mean, I want to get her story out there because, I mean, the history of tragedy is kind of, I mean, there's always new tragedy. One kind of buries the other and stuff. A month or two goes by and there's something new, right? And mm-hmm. She seems like she was kind of erased from history almost. And I didn't think that was right. You know, with this, I mean, especially knowing that the main suspect, I mean, is still alive.
Yeah. And it seems like if something like this happened, an 11-year-old girl, like I can only imagine that the community would have been pointing fingers and like scrambling to figure out what had happened. Like this young man that was arrested and eventually charged stayed, like was that known in public or in the neighborhood and amongst your family who it was that was charged?
No, none. In speaking to my family, we haven't spoken to everybody, like all the cousins and my dad's cousins or anything, nobody knew that it actually went to trial. That's the interesting thing. But wow. Also, it was mentioned in the paper at that time that, I mean, a suspect was released on bail in 1971. So I don't think they read the papers back then because they didn't want to read about whatever it might have been. So it's just weird how nobody seems to know that there was actually a trial.
Wow.
It was kept hush-hush.
Yeah, it's just such a different world because nowadays, like maybe the kids like that was arrested's name and photo may not be in the paper, but you know, all the details of the case would be out there.
Especially with social media, I mean, it's anything you do would be all over Twitter and Facebook and everything.
Yeah,
you know?
Now, for people out there, how can they support you in your journey to, you know, find justice for Geraldine? Like, what can regular people do to get involved in this?
That's a good question. I mean, really, the best way if people are affected by this is to contact local police, Winnipeg police, and or the Manitoba legal system, and also try to contact MLAs and politicians and ask, say, what happened here? Can you explain this to us?
There's also, I don't know if you're involved in this, but there's also a Facebook group that a lot of people who knew Geraldine and family members were in there talking, discussing her case. And I found a lot about her, like photos and old news clips through this Facebook group. I'm thinking aside from that, there's probably not a lot out there to read about her, but what is this Facebook group for people who want to see these things?
Yeah, it's called Justice for Geraldine and Satie, and there's a lot of stuff up there. All the newspaper articles are there from the time and new information as well. I mean, there's people that, I mean, not only our family but friends and people in the neighborhood that lived through that. And I mean, they may have been going to a different school or something. Like, it was, you know, if that happens in your neighborhood, it just rocks your world. And people haven't forgot about it. And it's really nice that people are coming forward and being supportive and just saying, I think of Geraldine often, or every time I drive by Junior's, I think about her, or whatever it is. And I think especially as people age now, that's one of those things that they want to get closure for. I mean, mm-hmm. Just as decent human beings. Mm-hmm.
And just the idea of closure. Another dark part of this that I read is that your grandfather, Geraldine's dad, he passed not long after this happened to her. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah. 2 years later in 1972, I mean, he basically died of a broken heart. He was really, really racked with guilt. And I mean, if I wish I could have told him, I said, you know, it's not your fault. You have no idea this was going to happen. But that was his baby girl. You know, she was the youngest in the family. And I mean, all of my other aunts and uncles moved out of the house except for my dad. So it was just Geraldine and my dad. And I mean, I can't imagine what that'd be like.
No. And yeah, even when I see the photos of Geraldine, you can tell she's the baby. There'll be like, you know, everyone is so much bigger than her, and there's just a little girl in the photo. The one photo that's very touching is her on your granddad or on her dad's knee on a boat or something. And it's it's a very sweet moment and a very beautiful photo and beautiful memory. But the idea of like, I could never imagine how it must feel, but I know that if his last interaction was to send her for a quick run to the store and this happens, yeah, he could never have expected this to happen. But the way that would weigh on a parent is just unimaginable. So,
oh yeah. You know, I just could imagine that.
Ryan, then if anyone out there has any information that may be of use, like, who would be the police force handling this? Because I believe even at the time, the police force in those old articles, I don't even think that exists anymore. As you mentioned, the city kind of amalgamated. Who would they contact?
Yeah, you're right. Back in 1974, St. Vital was rolled into City of Winnipeg, and then they kind of used City of Winnipeg's resources, fire department, police, and everything like that. You can contact the local police here, or Crime Stoppers, or you can go on Justice for Geraldine Sateen and drop a private message or like that, because we also have, I should say, a private investigator that looks at Geraldine's site as well as helping out, that anything that people provide, we're following up on.
Sorry to interrupt the episode like this, but I want to take a moment and tell you about bonus content that's available on the premium feed. But before I tell you about the bonus content, I should remind you that there is in fact a separate and much better nighttime podcast feed than the one you're listening to now. What makes this premium feed better, you ask? Well, it's listener funded, so there aren't distracting ads like this or the others you've heard. But most importantly, the premium feed includes exclusive episodes, bonus content, and prior nighttime episodes that are no longer available here on the free feed. As an example of the bonus content available on the premium feed, shortly after the release of this episode, I'll be releasing an extended excerpt from our discussion that was unable to be included in this episode, in which Ryan and I discuss what we know about the initial suspect in Geraldine Sette's murder. If you're following this case, you won't want to miss that. I should also mention that all annual premium feed subscribers receive a free nighttime welcome pack that includes things like stickers, buttons, and magnets. So if any of this is of interest to you, please consider listening to the show there. You can go premium at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. Again, you can go premium at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. Now let's get back to the episode.
Now, with the details of this suspect still, you know, being out there, how does that make you feel? Like, do you feel like there's a chance that new information could come up? You know, you didn't mention the fact that somebody had been looking to testify, but that got derailed. Like, what do you think the chances are of something, you know, happening with this after all this time?
I'm hopeful. You know, I mean, people are getting older now, and people have information that can help us. And as per the police, all we need is one or two people to come forward and corroborate that he confessed to the crime, because this main suspect did confess to a lot of people and bragged and boasted about it.
Him bragging and boasting, is this just stuff you've heard, like, kind of through the rumor mill, or is there anything you're like that we can point at where, like, you know, see, that's where he did it? Or is this just like kind of people have like kind of through the grapevine sort of thing?
Well, in talking to my dad, like right when I started investigating this, he said that he had friends at a local school that had family members or friends that were telling him about this, said, "You won't believe what's happening, what I'm being told here. You know, he's boasting about killing Geraldine." And I mean, we don't know whether he did or not. I mean, the kids in the school back then might have just thought that he was being wish fulfillment, or being big man on campus or something like that. You know, I mean, you hear of all these cases where people commit, or they admit to crimes that they didn't commit, which always kind of blows my mind. It's like, why would you purposely try to get yourself in trouble? But the psychology is that you want to, I guess, be somebody through any attention, even if it's negative attention. So, I mean, I think the mindset back then was that, I mean, oh, he's telling somebody else he didn't do it. He just pretending he did. But
I could see that, but then on the other hand, like, I wonder if this person, you know, could possibly have just talked themselves into some real trouble. But I can't imagine the police would make an arrest and be willing to go to trial based on, you know, he told some people at school, like they must have had more against him that they were willing to go that far. But I expect, like, if we could see that file, that they just, like, they have stuff, like they have a lot, but just not enough to slam dunk it. And maybe it's one of those stories where we're going to hear someone, you know, like what often happens in these cases that have gone on for this time, this amount of time, is some relationship breaks down, someone's betrayed or something changes. And then, you know, the details just come out. And I'm really hopeful that, you know, you shaking the branches is going to encourage something like that to happen.
Well, exactly, Jordan. That's a great point. And that's what we really thought might happen going into it. That, I mean, like you say, people have fallings out. I mean, friends, family, whoever it is. And I mean, all we need is somebody to come forward and just say, he confessed to me. This is what he said. We need specific details that would only be known to the killer. You know, because hearsay is not enough. And there's plenty of hearsay.
And what I heard about the suspect that they're linking to Geraldine, or at least they were at that point to her murder, is that the person did go on to have a troubled life after that. Like, I believe they've been identified and they've been connected to other either crimes or suspected crimes. Like, can you give me any information on what the rumors are as far as what this person may have been involved in later in life?
Well, I mean, I was told by a reliable source that they were, like, potentially a suspect in some other murders as well. I don't know which ones. I mean, you can imagine that, I mean, somebody, and this is just speculation, right? I mean, somebody, if they're 14 years old and they're kind of starting out their adolescence of going out in that world and trying to make sense of it, that, I mean, I don't think that type of thing just kind of goes away. And doing some research on this main suspect revealed just court records going back to about 1989, there's acrimonious divorces from ex-wives, restraining orders, lawsuits, and none of which makes anybody a murderer or anything like that, but it does help to paint a picture of an irresponsible life.
And that was, I had brought up the Facebook group earlier, and that was something that in the Facebook group, I saw this suspect being discussed and people sharing past accounts of what they were like, but also sharing court records of various, like, court appearances and stuff. And yeah, it does paint, like, it doesn't paint the portrait of a killer, but it certainly paints a disturbing picture of somebody who could fit the profile. And I hope that, you know, if just as you said, if there's anyone out there who knows anything about Geraldine's murder, or ever, you know, had someone confess or say something about it to them, that they will do the right thing and come forward, because that's likely all it's going to take.
Another thing too I should add here is that this is the first time that I've mentioned this to anybody, so you have the exclusive on this. This main suspect, according to a very reliable resource that lived in the neighborhood back then, said this main suspect started out killing cats and other small animals, and rabbits and squirrels and stuff like that. And that's what I was told, apparently.
I want to thank you for joining Nanai for our discussion surrounding the murder of Geraldine City. If anyone listening has any information regarding this case, please contact Crime Stoppers, Winnipeg Police, or if all else fails, contact me directly and I can get the information to the proper people anonymously. And with that, we'll begin to wrap up this episode, but before we part, I have some thanks. First, a big thanks to Ryan for sharing an evening with me and with the listeners of Nighttime. Next, a big shout out to Monty Data for contributing the music for this episode. It's a piece called Noir Tokyo. And lastly, a massive thanks to everyone who listens to Nighttime, as without your interest and your support, this show would be as pointless as it would be impossible. But with that said, keeping the show alive is and has always been an uphill battle. So if you want to take a bit of weight off the show's back, please subscribe to the premium feed. For about the price of a cup of coffee, you can keep the show alive at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And on the topic of the premium feed, let me thank the newest subscribers, Caper Jen, Hannah, Michelle, and Sharon. Thank you for going premium. And for anyone else who'd like to support the show, but can't help financially, you can give me a big hand by simply sharing this episode on social media and letting like-minded friends know what we're doing here. If you have any story ideas or if you want to give feedback on the show, reach me at nighttimepodcast.com/contact or find me on social media. I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I'm often live on the Nighttime Podcast YouTube channel. So until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.